place is different. Special. The others don't want to talk about it because it scares them. But we all know it. We all feel it. Do you really think all this is an accident? That we, a group of strangers, survived? Many of us with just superficial injuries? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, John?
The island.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back!
Hello and welcome to The Storm. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and in my luggage are seven knives.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and in my luggage are as many knives as it takes.
And I'm Neil Miller, and in my luggage there are zero knives, but there is one George R.R. Martin doll that has a little battery in it that keeps getting flagged by airport security every time I go through.
That's what you get for taking George with you on trips.
It was very hard to explain to the guy at SFO.
You are listening to The Storm, a lost rewatch podcast. Just rewatching anything, you know, rewatch whatever you want. No, it's about the show Lost, specifically the first season of the ABC show Lost. We are up to episode 4, Walkabout, which we will be discussing this episode. If this is your first time joining us, first of all, the other episodes are in our feed. Please feel free and go back. But our format for the show is we have something called The Calm, which means we will just be talking about Lost episodes we have seen on this rewatch up through Walkabout. If this is your first time watching Lost, we will pretend to be exactly where you are, and every time we screw up, I will bleep it out in post-production. Then we go into a section called The Storm, which we use all of our knowledge and the combined knowledge of the internets and our listeners from 15 years of being a fan of Lost to talk about the episode. This episode will be very fun in that regard, I feel. That's a non-stormy way of trying to entice you into the storm. But first, Joanna, do we have any reviews for this Lost Rewatch podcast?
We do have a few reviews for this Lost Rewatch podcast. A few negative reviews, and then we'll hit a positive on the way out. 2 stars from Eric. I don't owe you a proper name pronunciation because you're
you
about
didn't follow
to say
the rules.
Mean things about me. Fast forward through Joanna. Trust me, she's very annoying and interrupts everyone else. Also, everyone is wrong and she's always right. I bet she has at least 3 cats. I only have 1 cat. Thank you very much. All right. And then this one comes from 2 stars. Stick to Writing by Professor Poppin Lockhart. Even though I think the hosts are clearly knowledgeable and I love reading their articles, they are painful to listen to. The cadence of their voices is grating. Their jokes are awful. The ad reads are awkward, blah, blah, blah. Because I love Game of Thrones, I forced myself to listen to 10 plus episodes, but I couldn't take it anymore. I've never left a negative review on any podcast before, but this had to be done. And P.S. Dave Gonzalez, you don't have to be so self-indulgent and word vomit every single thing you think. Your jokes aren't landing, buddy. I mean, that's patently not true, but. By the way, listeners,
also 10? You got through 10?
I asked Dave if I could read that negative thing about him before I read it. But I had consent. All right. Two more. 1 star, 5 stars to 1 by Jonah 2D. I've been a long time listener of the podcast and have thoroughly enjoyed their relevant pop culture discussions regarding Game of Thrones and the off-season tour. I'm sorry. Game of Thrones and the off-season tour. However, in the course of 1 week, they went from one of the most relevant podcasts covering the most popular show on television, Game of Thrones, to a show that started airing 15 years ago, Lost, which has the lamest ending of arguably any show until Game of Thrones. The majority of people do not want to go back and relive the disappointment of spending multiple seasons investing in a show to be reminded that Lost is really just I mean, A, that's not true, but B, I'm... Nope, that's also untrue. This person doesn't understand the ending of Lost. Okay. This is a major misstep for your podcast and a letdown for a lot of your audience. Send a raven when you become relevant again. I mean, five stars for that last sentence. Send a raven when you become relevant again, because that's pretty funny. We're actually going to address some of this stuff in terms of like, so stay tuned for the opening of this episode, because we're going to talk about how we're still going to be talking about relevant pop culture. I actually think Lost is incredibly relevant, and also some notes from some people who were disappointed by the ending and why they're excited to join us for this rewatch. Okay. One more review and then we're out of here. 4 stars, agent_olive needs more Storm. I want more Storm. I heartily disagree with those that said the debut Lost rewatch episode was too Storm heavy. I enjoyed the first episode because it was so Storm heavy. Lost is extremely myth-centric, borderline reliant. Even if it runs askew occasionally in later seasons, I want to stick around for this rewatch, but I need more connection off of threads from those early episodes to later seasons and stories. If you wanted this pod to be a full-fledged explainer for a blind Lost watch, that's fine too. But if you're going to stick with the Storm format, I implore you to get real. There's the spoiler there. Stormy with us. Rest assured, agent_olive, I think we've got a really good Storm section for you this week. That is bolstered by a lot of emails that we got. We have a lot of emails sort of peppered through this episode. People are really excited about this last rewatch and have a lot of thoughts and know a lot of things. So if you want to join in the conversation, you can email us stormofspoilers@gmail.com. For now, we might be changing that, but for right now, stormofspoilers@gmail.com. You can send us, your thoughts, your theories, your trivia. We've got some real diehard fans watching along with us, and that's really exciting. It's only going to make this show better. So those are my reviews.
Excellent. Moving on, Neil, your segment, yes. I believe, last week you said you're going to be retooling the name every once in a while. What are we calling our formerly Send a Raven, since that's not series accurate anymore?
Well, it's still Found Signals for now, TBD to change. We have tons of news here. The first of which is sort of an update on the state of the podcast and the Patreon, which is at patreon.com/stormofspoilers. By the time you hear this episode, there will be updates to the Patreon as far as the new levels. We're coming up with fun names for them. We have a bunch of new bonus content that we're going to roll out. Most important of which, for those who are big fans of the off-season tour, is that we will be doing weekly storm chasing bonus segments in which we will be talking about other topics. Sometimes it will be us each picking a topic. Sometimes it'll all be on one topic. This week, I believe we're each bringing our own thing to talk about. So those get in at the middle level. It doesn't have, it's currently called the Maester level. That is where you will start getting the bonus content. Check the Patreon for sure, because we are, I believe, adding even more than what we had during Game of Thrones, which is weird to say. But there's a lot of good stuff in there.
I think we thought we were going to be doing less, but it turns out we're going to be doing more.
Yes.
Yeah. And some of those bonus pods, are going to be likely be accessible to the public as well. Like, you'll occasionally get a bonus pod in your feed just so you like know what, you know, can check our pulse and know what we're still up to. And see if you want to join us in those episodes. And then also we should say, there will be an option for you, the listener, to pick what we cover in some of those bonus pods. So it's all happening on the Patreon, patreon.com. So thanks for that.
And we also have a new website coming soon, which will be fun.
Yes. And then, so as I mentioned, we got a bunch of emails in from people. The first subject that I want to bring up, we got multiple emails on this, one from Pat, one from Marissa, a couple more, asking whether they should spoil or not. These are first time Lost watchers who are listening to the podcast. We've got the comm section, which feels safe for them. But if they like spoilers generally, but are unsure if a show like Lost, which is so like mystery box and twist dependent, is something that they want to have spoiled. So I just wanted to ask you guys, like you, Neil and Dave, what do you think? Do you think that our listeners who are watching for the first time should journey with us into the storm? Should they stay in the calm? Let's start with Neil. What do you think about that?
Well, this is an interesting one, because we actually we have this dynamic in my household right now where one of my housemates has never watched it and the other one has. So I'm kind of on the side of like stay in the calm for maybe at least the first season, if not the first two seasons, because it's, there are some really fun mysteries and twists and things that are really cool to discover. It's really hard. Like that's the hardest way to do this because there's going to be, I mean, you could just Google just about anything, Lost related, and you're going to get a million spoilers because the internet has well documented everything that happened on Lost. So it's tough, but I think it's kind of fun, if you try it. So I would almost say live in the calm and then see what happens. Although as Dave's probably about to point out, the execution absolutely does matter.
Dave?
Yeah. So remember that podcast, Cast of Kings?
Yeah.
So I used to listen to it and be incredibly frustrated just that there was information out there that wasn't being brought to bear. And I think that's the purpose of the storm for me. That being said, if this is your first time through it, I don't think that the storm is as immediately approachable as it might have been for Game of Thrones, because the storm for Game of Thrones was prognostication. So you could bet that what we were going to talk about was what was going to happen in future episodes or in future seasons based on what we knew. And because we were good at that, and because there have some leaks some seasons, frequently we were discussing how things were going to be right. This storm, I think we're going to be debating a lot of the same questions that are full series questions. I mean, I know we have even at the beginning, this like four episodes into season one now. And I don't know if those questions are even going to be interesting to somebody who's just in season one. So I think I'm with Neil that if you're doing a rewatch, there is no shame in this one. Well, I guess there wasn't any shame in Game of Thrones. Do what you need to do. But there's, I think, a benefit into at least getting through season one and then maybe backtracking to that pilot episode that one reviewer thought wasn't stormy enough, but a lot of people thought was too stormy. And if you understand any of what I'm saying in that episode, then go back and restorm. That's the listening schedule for me.
The restorm. Someone at our live show. So we had this live show in San Francisco for the end of Game of Thrones. Then we had this like little after party gathering at a bar nearby. And one of our listeners, I want to say it was Rochelle, told me that she had just listened to all of our storms from the final season of Game of Thrones back to back to back. And so she's like, I just heard Balon Greyjoy die like 10 times in a row. Cause that was the sound effect to listen out for. So anyway, yeah, you can always go back and listen to the storms. I'm with these guys. I think you should not go into the storm. If this is your first time ever, keep yourself pure and precious. Okay. So then another big question we've been getting from listeners, is to binge ahead or not. We got this email from Danny from Philly who wrote, I bitched a little online that you were taking the same pace one episode at a time instead of something more appropriate to the binge culture. I couldn't be more wrong. Now that we're a few episodes into the show, the pace is perfect. And I love the discussions you're having, with the need, that they need the room to breathe. I really love that you have to bleep stuff out during the comment section. It's really funny. Keep up the great work. You have great chemistry, Danny. So a lot of people have been binging ahead. I know a lot of our listeners, like in our Patreon who have been discussing it, are binging ahead. There's nothing wrong with binging ahead. Like, I understand, like, this is a compulsively watchable show. We're getting into the summertime. It feels like a good time to just like chow through, Lost. And I'm not worried about it because I asked, the host of a couple other rewatch podcasts, like, what do you do when your listeners binge ahead? And they're like, oh, it's fine. Then they just come back and listen to the episode. So I'm not really worried. Watch at your own pace. That being said, like, I have heard from a couple people that they're enjoying sort of the slowdown of watching a show week to week, which is something we very rarely do anymore, this way. So, I guess I'll start again with you, Neil. Like, what do you think about binging ahead or listening along with the podcast?
Well, I think, like you said, there's nothing wrong with binging ahead. I personally am probably going to go a couple episodes ahead and then loop back and, you know, like rewatch it right before we record. I think that it's funny because right now in our, like, culturally, we want to binge everything. And it felt, Game of Thrones feels like such an outlier because we all watched it week to week together. But a show like Lost, it's very dense and there's a lot to it and there's a lot going on. And it really is sort of the kind of show that it's better if you take it slowly. I feel like the folks who are probably binging ahead are probably folks who have seen it before, would be my guess. Because, you know, you want to get to, or you're like, if you're watching it with somebody and you kind of want to get to the next mystery to be able to talk about it, maybe, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I really like that if you slow this one down, there is something to sort of unpack in every single episode. And I think we're going to find that Lost really, you know, that's sort of the best way to talk about it, at least. So. Yeah, you know, go as far as you want, but it's from a podcast standpoint, I'm glad we're not trying to do it too, because then I feel like we'd skip over stuff.
And then Dave, what do you think about binging ahead or watching week to week?
I'm always for binging ahead, and you could always drop back and see what happens. Or I think what would happen is you'd binge ahead, and then our episodes will come out, and then you'll start listening to the episode and maybe figure out whether or not that's one you want to revisit. Maybe we bring something up or, something stormy, gets pointed out to you and you want to go back. But it's hard for me to argue against watching more television that's good. And I think this first season, binging ahead isn't going to lose momentum as we get further on into Lost. And there are some, pockets of, not great episodes. Maybe that's where you're going to naturally stop and wait for us to catch up to you. But I think at least in this first season, I would binge ahead just out of momentum and then loop back whenever the podcast came back, because these first season episodes are so rewatchable that, I don't know, this is like my multiple times to the first season. First season of Lost is great.
Great. Okay. And then really quickly, we got this message from Sarah in Honolulu. This is sort of addresses the ending question. Sarah wrote, "The problematic ending made me feel like the show didn't mean anything anymore, and I just have not really been able to rewatch without being bothered by it. Doing this with you all changes everything. I already feel less irritated by the ending after hearing your first podcast on the 2-episode pilot." So Sarah's email was longer, but it was just sort of about this idea of like, can I even bring myself to rewatch Lost if I felt burnt by the ending? We've all argued that we think that there's value in it. And we've also all argued, I think, that we don't think the ending is as bad as some people paint it out to be. So I just wanted to note that if you were feeling some hesitancy around it, this is just,
it's funny because it's, you know, I mean, the show premiered 15 years ago. It ended, 9 years ago. I'm super curious to find out. Like, I don't know if I remember specifically, like, if I had a problem with it, what was the problem? It's like, I'm ready to relitigate this one because, when you start going back through it, especially just as Dave mentioned, season one is so good. Like, I'm ready to just live in season one for as long as we need to. And then we'll kind of figure out the ending when we get there. You know, it might not be as bad this time around. Who knows?
Dave, do you have anything you want to add on the ending? I just sort of wanted to drop.
Yeah, it's not like they're going to throw us in cages and make us watch bad Lost episodes yet.
All right. And then this last email before we hop into the meat of the episode itself comes from Rebecca. And this is sort of a response to last week, but also applies to this week. Last week's episode was called Tabula Rasa. This was the, or Tabula Rasa, if you're Dave. This is the Kate episode. And we talked about what the title meant, but we forgot to talk about sort of it as a philosophical concept, the Tabula Rasa. And so this is Rebecca's email. She wrote, "I was kind of surprised at how little philosophical and political discussion I've heard so far, especially when talking about unified theories. I understand this is the first and foremost a TV podcast, and I love TV. Just in case you don't know, and I bet you do, Tabula Rasa is actually a super important concept of political theory, and especially to names like John Locke, David Hume, and Rousseau." And we should say that you've met John Locke. These are all names that will come up on the show. The show loves its political theorist, philosoph philosopher names on this show. Locke specialized, okay, this is back to Rebecca's email. Locke specialized in the idea of tabula rasa, that we are self-authored. We are people free from the sins of our nature. We are born new and governed by only the sensations of now and the reflections on self, which seems to basically explain the structure of the entire series, sensation and reflection. Also, fun tidbit I just read in researching for this email, it more directly translates as erased or scraped slate, which I think makes it all the more special to John Locke's storyline of all of their storylines, really. Their standing in society has been scraped clean. Their social and economic positions, which so frequently defined them before, are gone. So who are they now? And just to like get a word in before it comes, Locke also was a champion of democracy and a huge believer in the idea that man left in his natural state, operating only on selfishness, would never amount to anything. So it is by men coming together and working as a unit, we are as successful as we are today. By working together, man avoided dying alone. That's from Rebecca. So, live together, die alone, which may or may not be something that comes up again on the TV show Lost. But yeah, I'm so glad Rebecca flagged that, and it is good for us to remember that in the character-based stuff that is of interest to Lost, and in the mythology stuff that is of interest to Lost, this idea of political theory, this idea of the show's premise as a sociological experiment, given its roots in stuff like Survivor, is something that we should keep our eye on. So please do, Rebecca apologized like 9 times in her email for emailing us. Please don't, Rebecca. I love emails like this. Please email us stormofspoilers@gmail.com if you have other sort of political theory, or philosophy or sociology, ideas related to Lost. That's like the shit I love. So, did you guys have anything else you wanted to add about John Locke or, the concept of tabula rasa, Dave or Neil?
No, but I did learn this week that there was a cut scene from this episode where Kate and Locke are walking into the jungle, and she asks him about his name, or she asks him his first name, and he says John Locke, and Kate apparently, in that scene comments on it. But apparently there was something weird about the way it was shot. They couldn't use it, but like the idea that, Kate becomes aware that John Locke is, has the same name as a philosopher is sort of an interestingly self-aware thing for the show to almost do.
Love it. Dave, anything else?
No, I'm glad they didn't have that scene though. That's a little too much subtext as text for me, and Lost is right. Better than that.
It works better without it in the end.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, that is all I have to say. We have some more emails. You will find them in our storm section, but those are all the calm emails we have. So Dave.
Excellent.
Since you're technically the host of the show, and I'm sorry if it feels like you haven't been. What are we going to talk about?
No, you just stole from Neil's section. That's fine.
That's okay. My voice is still weird. So.
No, I'm happy to let it go. So here in the column, we're going to talk about Walkabout, which is an amazing episode. I've been reading some of those, looking back 10 years interviews because, a listener was very nice and found me on Twitter and then emailed us a whole bunch of stuff, and I'm going to get back to that. But I've been going through and reading it, and there's a whole bunch of sections on Walkabout, because Walkabout is like an amazing story that was first written, for John Locke, just for him to be a picked on blue collar worker and, mirror sort of the Boar plot of him, seizing his power on the island, and that the island just provided a place that he didn't have any of these preconceptions, that he had on the mainland. And that was the power that, Locke felt. But as we know, that's not how it turned out. Having seen Walkabout this week, the island gave John the ability to walk again. And the episode does a great job of sort of sixth sensing it, which is how a lot of Damon Lindelof references it, of providing an episode that is very emotionally character-based and straightforward when you first see it. And then the last scene, when we realize that John Locke's in a wheelchair, it changes your entire perception of everything you've seen before. It also makes his coworkers like really inappropriately
just
mean.
Just the worst.
Instead of just like minorly mean.
Randy and his shitty Andy Samberg hair. I could not. Yeah, that was some 2004 hair right there.
Really dates the show right there, that haircut. But yeah, what we end up getting is, I think the episode of the series that a lot of people point to, a lot of fans of the series pointed to as when they really hooked into a lot of the things that Lost would end up being. So we have not only flashbacks off the island, but flashbacks of things on the island, as we get to see the toe wiggle again and revisited from the pilot. And then we also have sort of the introduction of some key mysteries. In this one, the monster confronts Locke, and Locke decides to lie about it. And Jack sees a man in a suit that really freaks him out, walking into the desert, and that man disappears. And I guess I'm giving it away by calling it out as being like somewhat supernatural, but this is where Lost adds a couple supernatural things on top of what was just a polar bear and a mysterious monster before. And it's basically planting its flag as slightly more science fiction than at least the first three episodes would have you believe. Neil, what are your takeaways from Walkabout and what it has to contribute to, I guess, the direction this first season's going to go in?
Well, it's not only that it starts to sort of open up sort of the sci-fi elements of this show, but there's a lot of really cool little directorial tricks that Jack Bender, this is the second Jack Bender episode, right? We talked about last week being the first one. Yes. Okay. So there's things like there's no blue or green in Locke's flashbacks. So the flashbacks are intentionally sort of this like yellowy, like taupey color to sort of bring out a distaste for the environment that he was in before that. And then of course the little tricks, like they lowered the handles on the wheelchair so that when he's sitting at the table, you can't really tell, until you see it from the other side. Also, I love the little touches, like, anyone who's ever been to a chiropractor that has one of these machines knows what a stim machine is. That machine that he has next to his bed that he turns off is like you put the little electrodes on your muscles and it stimulates the muscles. And the way they explain it on the commentary track is this is why he's able to stand up immediately when his legs come back to work, is he uses this stimulating machine to.
Oh, electrify. So the muscles haven't atrophied. Yeah.
So his muscles have not atrophied. So it's like this little detail that's in there. But there's also stuff, where this episode continues the idea that we're still only a few days from the crash. So one of the things that they talked about was making sure that everybody in the background is still sort of always in motion, still doing stuff. Everybody's sort of still in that panicked mode of it hasn't been that long, even though technically for the actors, it's, I think, been almost a year since they shot the pilot at this point. So there's a lot of detail in this episode that I love. And then there's just this great central performance from Terry O'Quinn that I think is the first, I don't know. I think, Matthew Fox is great in the first episode. Evangeline Lilly is great sort of in her episode, but there's just something sort of next level to what Terry O'Quinn brings, especially in this episode. And, that's what I like about it. Did you know, another fun fact, I have tons of these, that this episode was almost called Lord of the Files, but they felt like Lindelof ultimately felt like it was too on the nose.
Walkabout's so good. Walkabout's good on like nine levels, but like,
right.
But Lord of the Files is really funny. I was reading. Listeners sent us so much good supplemental material. And it's so great. And I was rereading, this, essay that one of the writers, Javier Grillo Marxwatch wrote, a couple years ago. And I read it when he wrote it. It's a super long thing. What is it called? Like the Lost Confessions of Javier Grillo Marxwatch or something like that. Anyway, so it's about like he worked on the first two seasons of the show. He talks a lot about what those first two seasons were like for him. And some of the, you know, I'm less concerned than some people are about like what was planned and what wasn't and stuff like that. But what I think is interesting is like
that some people are.
I'm not talking about even talking about you. I wasn't talking about you. I just think that some people think that that is like a mark of quality. It's good to be interested in what was planned and what wasn't, which I think you are. But I don't think like just because something wasn't planned, that means it's bullshit, which some people take that attitude. Does that distinction make sense?
Yes, especially having read the essay you're about to reference.
Okay. So, I mean, I'm not even referencing what was planned and what wasn't. What I am referencing is like the ways in which they wrote certain characters for certain actors. And like Terry O'Quinn had been on Alias, J.J. Abrams' other show, which we talked a little bit about last week, in a pretty long run as a character. And his character on Alias is different than Locke, but I can see that they just like, they knew that they had Terry O'Quinn in their back pocket when they were crafting who Locke would be. And there's just like, there's no doubt in my mind. Like there, you know, we talked a bunch about, the idea that they were going to kill Jack off and this wasn't going to Jack off. Oh gosh. They were going to kill Jack and this wasn't going to be a show about a character like Jack, right? That was their original plan. And Javier in his essay claims that like he knew that the network wouldn't let them kill the like white male hero. But like had they done that and made like Kate the main like leader or whatever, you know, what you wind up with, there's just something about Locke, I guess, long rambling story short, that makes this show so much more special than it would be if it were just like a bunch of pretty people washed up on a beach and like, you know, and then fought. When you've got, not that Terry O'Quinn isn't like, you know, an attractive man, but like when you just have a character actor like Terry O'Quinn and then later another great character actor sort of becomes this other anchor of the show and that just deepens the show, so much. So, sorry, that was a roundabout, a walkabout to my point, I guess.
A good old walkabout. All right, so other things that happen in this episode. We learn, according to Lostopedia, we actually learn Claire's name this episode. So sorry I didn't beep that out for previous Lost podcast episodes. I don't know how much character names are spoilers, but we learn Claire's name here. She takes over the responsibilities of giving a eulogy because, as Neil mentioned, this is still pretty soon after the crash. I think the Bohr attack is the night of day 3. So at the night of day 4 is finally time to burn the fuselage, cremate the people inside. Neil.
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of setting up Claire as maybe being an emotional counterpoint to Jack. Because although we've seen Jack, you know, shirk off making decisions because he's in like a battle of the secrets with Kate, this is the first episode where we see Jack actively try not to be the leader and instead pass it off to Claire.
Well, yeah, we start to get multiple moments of leadership. You know, I think Claire and Hurley, who end up doing this together, are sort of the empathetic leaders of the group so far, you know, and then you also get that moment where they realize that they're out of food and Saeed sort of jumps into action and is like, all right, well, we can get food. We need to do this. We need to do that. So you have these different, what I like about this first season of Lost is that it continues to find things for the other characters to do that make them interesting while we're following sort of the main story, which up to this point, we're pretty sure that like Jack and Kate are a very main story. Obviously Locke becomes incredibly more important in this episode. But there's constantly these things to do. One other fun fact that I liked specifically about Claire was that during the scene where Claire and Jack are talking about the memorial that she's going to do, Emily DeRaven who's the actress who plays Claire, wanted to wear a hat. She's like, the sun is, intense. I want to wear a hat. And Jack Bender, the director, is like, we don't want the characters to feel settled yet. He's like, so we didn't change much of their wardrobe. The only changes are that some of their scars have started to heal. So they kept this sort of immediacy to it, which I thought, this is just like these weird little touches that Jack Bender, it's like, oh yeah, now I get it. I know you're brilliant. But yeah, so you really start to connect with these characters, on an emotional level. And I also love that, you know, we start this episode with Locke, who up to this point has been very separated from the group. And we end this episode with Jack being separated from the group because Jack can't, for reasons that are his own, Jack can't deal with the memorial service. He's not dealing well with saying goodbye to the dead or, you know, whatever's going on with Jack. So there's that shot where it pans down and you see the burning fuselage in the back. I think it's maybe the last shot of the episode. And so we've sort of flipped Jack and Locke. Locke is now very necessary to the group because he's the guy who hunted the boar.
Yeah.
And Jack is sort of, he's not participating. And so he's sort of off to the side now, which I think is, it's fascinating how quickly this show can flip dynamics. You know, Locke was a very weird character, very mysterious character last week when he was returning Walt's dog. This week he's the hero of the group, but now we know sort of why he was acting the way he was in the first couple episodes, which this is one of my favorite things about the show.
Well, and something we should say for the calm listeners, and we'll get into it in the storm, is like, there's also a mystery, the mystery of like, there's this monster something, this high camera angle perspective thing on the show that we can't talk about here in the calm, but like, Locke saw it and like, lived to tell the tale. You know what I mean? Whatever it did to the pilot, it didn't do to Locke. And so we'll talk about that in the storm, but, I don't think it was a really tall boar, is what I will say. So.
Would you like to know, and this is somehow still calm.
Wow, can't believe it.
Would you like to know what Damon Lindelof told Terry O'Quinn he was looking at? Because it's really weird. So Terry O'Quinn said, like, they... obviously, I don't know if they knew what the monster was going to look like at this point, but... Terry O'Quinn asked him, he's like, what am I looking at in this scene? What am I playing off of? And he said, all I can tell you is it's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen.
I love that.
And that's it. And then, so that's what Terry O'Quinn is acting against. He has no idea what he's supposed to be looking at.
He's basically doing like that gif of Hugh Jackman in the fountain.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about?
It's like, it's melting my face off. It's so great.
That's funny.
Whatever it is.
Joanna. Yeah. You know what time it is. It's time to rewatch Shannon. So, this week's episode, we have Boone and Shannon have a little bet about fishing, and Shannon says she could catch a fish. And technically, does she catch a fish?
Also technically, yes. Okay, not our best episode for our girl, Shan. Can I do a quick segment that I'm thinking of making a regular feature on this show?
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling it the most 2004 things about this episode. Shannon's zigzag hair part, which I forgot to mention earlier in our rewatch, one of an iconic 2004 fashion statement. So Shan's zigzag part, Shannon's earrings, most of it is Carlisle sibling related. Shan's earrings, Boone being called Metro as an insult by Sawyer. That feels very 2004 to me. And Randy's hair, which we already discussed. So, I might make this a poll, a weekly poll. What's the most 2004 thing in this episode? But, those are my candidates for right now. Yeah, Shannon, it was so funny because when I was rewatching this episode, I was thinking about that, show Bible document that we were, referencing in last week's episode when we were talking about Taboola Rasa, and I'm just gonna call it Taboola Rasa because it makes me laugh. And I just want to remind you what Shannon said, which was, while we perceive her to be a little more than a rich bitch, Shannon is considerably more complicated. Smart, manipulative, and extremely capable of being ruthless in order to get what she wants. Shannon will be a constant catalyst for conflict in her new surroundings. Okay, blah, blah. So this idea
until she's spoiler.
Yeah. So like this idea that like that Locke being able to hunt is one kind of survival skill, and what Shannon does to Charlie is another kind of survival skill. Is it a kind of survival skill that we feel super great rooting for? Maybe not necessarily, but like this Shannon move here where she gets a fish to shove in Boone's face, feels very survivor to me. You know what I mean? Like, this is, the schemers make it, you know, just as far as the people who can actually hunt boar make it often. So.
Right. And I think in terms of allegiance that we're supposed to have towards these characters, it's been helping me in the rewatch, reminding myself that if you're just watching the show and you don't know about the mysteries at the center of it, the best way to watch it is these people making alliances behind each other's backs. So Shannon's work here, although once again, they successfully write the character in a way to make me not like her. It is to, you know, not only show that she can manipulate these people, but probably to show that Charlie and Hurley paired off, and to show that Charlie might hold something against Shannon in the future. But it is better to think about it in a Survivor-esque, who's going to be king of these people, even though they're not thinking about that yet. I think the show is using that to build tension. And so sometimes I forget, because there are episodes like Lockabout, like every act break is out on John Locke, either in flashback or on the island. So they're keeping it around the episode, but a lot of the side tension still being built with this not being a show about a crippled guy who could walk encountering a beautiful monster in the jungle. For everybody else, it's still, you know, we get to, for instance, as an audience, we're four episodes into Saeed. He seems to have his stuff together, but he's also the king of the secret-keeping group that Kate is, you know, sort of the in-between between him and Jack in terms of having a leadership council that's starting to form. But this episode, we get him softened a little bit. Not only does he, you know, apologize for his outburst when Kate, you know, brings him back his broken machinery, but later on, Claire gives him some mysterious photographs that hint that there's more behind Saeed than survivalist ex-Republican guard.
You know, Neil, what else I love about the Saeed thing?
What?
Is that we, Saeed so far is one of the characters that has like an urgency around like, we need to figure this out. We need to get off the island. Let's build fires. Let's do a radio thing. And this week we find out a little bit of why. Like, why is Saeed trying to get off the island? Or why is he the one who has sort of urgency? And, I really like that. It's just like a weird, you know, that's, that scene where he looks at the pictures of the woman is something that I feel like shows that aren't as good as Lost or not as patient as Lost would cut out. And it's a really sort of important thing because you understand why he's then so frustrated when the radio thing gets broken. You know, he's like, Saeed wants to get the hell out of here. And I love that.
And I was going to throw to you to say the other character I think that gets the appropriate amount of softening this episode is we get to go back and get more background on Rose while we're on the island.
Yes!
Joanna, take it away. What are we? So we got some good trauma talk from Jack, but what do you read this entire Rose situation as? Why is it here at this point of the story?
Jack and Rose, my favorite Titanic couple. So I love the Jack and Rose stuff in this episode, as you might predict. I should really quickly say I just added another thing to my 2004 watch list, which is the mention of the TPS reports in Locke's flashback, which is an Office Space joke. So I feel like we don't make Office Space jokes as fast and furious as we did in 2004, even though that movie came out in 1999. All right. Jack and Rose. Rose is, you know, the woman who was sitting across from Jack on the plane and the plane went down and her husband is not there on the beach with them and she's convinced he's still alive. She's got his wedding ring on a chain. And this is, you know, something we'll talk about a lot in this series is the idea. You might have heard this phrase. It's the name of an episode. I don't think it's a spoiler to say man of science, man of faith. This idea of like faith-based survival. How do we get through something through faith? How do we get through something through like science, through like actual physical, tangible proof of life? Sort of thing. These are some warring concepts on the show. And we see in Locke, who's been healed magically by crashing on this island, this strong man of faith storyline start to like lift off. Because like even though Locke isn't not like overtly, you know, Christian or anything like that. This is like a faith-based, this is a spiritual story for him. He's like, some greater power, some beautiful monster that I'm gazing at, something has, you can just see it on his face. This whole like, oh my God, this is a miracle. This isn't science. Science didn't cure me. This is a miracle cure, that I've experienced on this island. And for Rose, I think it's related to that, is like, she believes her husband, is alive. And so this is like a faith-based thing. And it's something that it's hard for, like, Jack doesn't love hearing that. You know what I mean? Like, Jack is doing fine when he's like, you need to hydrate, you need to stay warm, you need to take care of yourself. Here's my doctorly bedside manner. I can handle this conversation. And then when she goes in the territory of like, I'm sure my husband's still alive, Jack's like, don't enjoy this anymore. And we will in the storm section talk about, some other reasons why Jack might have such a reaction, to that. But, I think thematically that's why this is here. Neil or Dave, do you have any other sort of ideas of why that's knitted into the story, in this way?
Well, there's the abruptness then of Jack seeing someone else in the jungle, which is like, that really fucks with Jack because, you know, Jack, we've seen him use his science, use his medical talents. And I think that's what leads to that scene at the end where he's alone by himself, is like, Rose just said this ominous thing to him, which he didn't believe. And then he saw a random person like in the jungle, that sort of disappears immediately when he goes to follow it. It's like, Jack's really having a time. He's really having a time.
No. Like, best case scenario, he's like tired and had to kill somebody yesterday and he's hallucinating. Worst case scenario, everything Rose said about the tail section, like, they're probably wondering where we are. Not only that, they're like so far ahead, they formed the other clan of Survivor that's on the other side, and they're already like scheming way ahead of us. So a mysterious person is not something you want to see in a jungle day three after you've like, you know, been in a horrible plane crash and sustained head injuries, especially not if you're Jack, who is like struggling to find a scientific purpose for this. Oh, Lost, are you magic? Are you just like this weird Survivor thing? Let's talk about some storm topics after I give my co-hosts one final chance to point out something with this little anecdote about my rewatch of Walkabout. So my rewatch of Walkabout, Lost is such a beautifully shot show in Hawaii. I realized that I still had my Neil-sanctioned Game of Thrones television settings on and was wondering why like Locke's sweaty head was popping like pixelated white. So let this be a reminder to you that Lost is properly shot for normal television settings. Neil, anything else you want to add before we jump into the storm for Walkabout?
Yes. One cool, since you mentioned how it was shot. So in the scene where it begins with Hurley and Sawyer fighting over the food, you'll notice that like the whole thing is handheld camera, so the camera's very shaky, and then the camera immediately becomes calm when the knife hits next to Sawyer.
Nice.
So it's like immediately calm, and then the same thing in the flashbacks, it's very still, and it's very still and sort of sterile, and it's sort of this it's interesting that they make all the lock stuff sort of like all the flashbacks so unique, and it really does sort of pull you out of what's happening on the island. And that is something they go back to a bunch, as we'll see.
Joanna, anything we need to pick up before we go into the storm?
Yeah, I'm just going to flag three things really quickly. Number one, I'll just say that Locke's like, don't tell me what I can't do, which he says, and he talks a lot about destiny. Like those are two things that like are important to Lost. So, hey, you've heard them for the first time. Don't tell me what I can't do. And Locke's idea that he's like burdened with some sort of destiny. this frustrated Destiny that we see in his flashbacks. And then, like, we haven't even talked about the fact that he, like, talks to a sex worker and like, pretends that she's his girlfriend and stuff like that. It's incredibly pathetic. And I don't mean that
for $90 an hour.
And I don't mean that
feels like a lot even in 2004 time.
I don't mean pathetic in a shitty way. I just mean like I feel empathy for him and that I'm empathetic. Like, I was just like, that is,
he's lonely.
It's hard to watch. So there's that. There's, I don't know how accurate Naveen Andrews, who's playing, who's British born Indian playing Iraqi. I don't know how accurate his accent is, but I do know that I feel like the writers were fucking with him when they gave him the sentence transceiver to triangulate transmission signal, and made him roll every single one of those R's. So, if you have a better sense of that accent work, please let me know. And then the last thing I want to say is, like, the boars that sort of are like, you know, rustling through the dead bodies on the beach. Wild pigs, I talked about chickens before in Hawaii. Wild pigs, are such a big thing, on Hawaii. You know, if you've been there, like, they serve a lot of, pork is a thing they eat a lot of, but, the wild pigs, you can come across them when you're on a hike. They are actually kind of quite scary. And actually once my aunt was out walking, she had these like very scary, like pit bull dogs that she would like walk and hike with. And she was out with she worked at the Hawaii Opera, and she was out with some Hawaii Opera people, walking with the dogs. And the dog went and like sort of attacked one of these pigs just because they're like, I don't know, they're both animals, they're doing their things. But then the pig wasn't like dead. And so then my aunt had to like kill a pig in front of like the opera people. It was like a whole thing. Anyway, Hawaii, it's a crazy place. There are pigs and things happen in the woods. So that's all I wanted to say about that. Yeah, those are all my calm thoughts, I guess. Okay. One last thing. And I said this elsewhere before, but Hurley and Charlie, I think of them as the Hufflepuffs of the island, and I loved their fishing scene together, as Neil mentioned. And I love it when two Hufflepuffs get together. So there you go.
Ooh, and I have a fun storm fact about that scene when we come back.
Excellent.
Which we will right after this.
We want to thank our small council members. We are still catching up with all the new ones that joined last month. We thank you so much for your interest in Game of Thrones. We are still trying to get through you. So thank you to Jillian, Kate, Johnson, Arnold, William, Jillian, Kate, Johnson, Arnold, Jeremy M. Johnson, William Burbridge, Skylark 88, Whateveritis 12, Liza Alcantar, Joe Torrens Fernandez, Miriam Erickson, Paul, Asia Glover, Alexis Hamilton, Brian Hopkins, Keys, Kelly Eidson, Tay, Chase, Amanda Rhodes, Shannon Vincent, Miranda Blankenship, Bailey Carlin. Thank you guys all so much. If I bungled your name, I apologize.
And I'd like to add to our boundless thanks Amanda Sprague, Kyle Davis, Sean Nee, Kobe Jackson, Katie Chapman, Matt Thompson, Allison Van Winkle, Davia Gianni, Research Flat Earth, which is funny unless you believe it, Carrie Welby / Solomon, Zoe Fuchs, Florence, Vanessa Nimi, Maggie Kitterman, Kathy Kubita, Karina Jansen, Rick Russell, Renee, Nathan Melahan, James Johnson.
And I would like to bring it all full circle by thanking the following people. Jennifer, Nefertiti, Herbert, Fibertarian, okay, Holly Karakos, Brandon W. Duke, Justin, Brett McKenzie, Laura Orlando, Mary Rossi, Jody Larson, Time Traveler Creative, Dan A., Mark Schrade, Corey Sebesta, Amanda Mitchell, Sarah Wingo, Chelsea Anglin, Rosemary, Terry Dormer, and Christina Rudy. Thank you, all of you. You're great.
And we're back. We're here in the storm. That means we could talk about everything. Joanna has wrested control of the storm away from me, and I've been put in a hatch, pressing a button every week.
No!
I get to come out and talk about the storm.
Everyone wants to hear your storm thoughts. Everyone, we're not trying to hatch you away. We want you to break free, run to the ocean. It's not toxic outside. Anyway, yeah, let me run down. We got a bunch of emails for the storm section as well. And let me just run down a few things.
Wait, I have a fact.
Hit me with a
fact.
Remember,
I promised a storm fact.
Oh, I wanted to say, like, I was going to mention the whole, like, Jack sees someone, but I, like, didn't know how to talk about the calm. And then Neil's like, and then Jack sees someone. And I'm like, but you nailed it. But I was
Jack
like,
sees a guy.
Jack sees someone.
Yeah. Maybe it's part of the tailies. We don't know.
Another fun fact from the commentary, we talked about Charlie and Hurley.
Yeah.
And their fun scene together. The Jack Bender and David Fury, who did the commentary track for this, referenced them as the Laurel and Hardy of the island, which I love.
Oh, yeah.
But originally this scene was supposed to end with Jin showing up and reaching in and getting, like, barehanding a fish and giving it to Charlie. So they cut it because I think they didn't want to really super spoil how good Jin is at fishing yet. And, just the idea that when Charlie brings Shannon the fish, Charlie didn't even catch the fish.
Well, I thought best case scenario, Hurley finally spared
right.
himself a fish.
You know? So I just love that, like, weird little detail of things. Also I don't know if we found this anywhere, but they did mention that they went back into the pilot and inserted the wheelchair because they didn't really decide until later that Locke was
right,
in a wheelchair.
Yeah, because they didn't know.
Mm-hmm. But it's wild that they went back and put that in the pilot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also you see someone using it to dump wood. Is it Sawyer? Someone's using it to dump wood in this episode.
They use it to carry around luggage in last week's episode too, I think.
That's great. All right. So some storm notes from Matt Farley, who has a longer email, but okay. So one thing is the smoke monster ticking printer noise playing at Locke's desk seems more important in hindsight, knowing the role the Man in Black will play in Locke's life.
Yeah, those made my storm notes. Sorry.
Okay. I'm sorry. Do you want to hit me with your storm notes?
No. I'm just, mine are all based around Locke as the villain, which I see is now a
okay,
bullet point later on.
We have a bullet point for that, yes. Rose says to Jack, I'm letting you off the hook in regards to him agreeing to keep her company until her husband gets back from the bathroom. This is the same thing that Boone says to Jack later in the season on his deathbed and what his future is. Sarah tells him before he performs spinal surgery on her after he promised she would dance at her wedding. So this is a recurring thing. Jack's martyr complex. People keep trying to let him off the hook.
Jack refusing to be off the hook.
Yeah. And then finally, let's talk about what Jack saw. The man in the suit with the sneakers, who is not the actor who usually plays Christian Shepherd, but is supposed to be Christian Shepherd, Jack's father. Locke encountering the smoke monster in this episode is interesting for a couple reasons. First, we know that Christian Shepherd's appearance on the island is actually the monster. That's a question mark we'll get to. So Jack sees the man in black on the beach right before he heads into the jungle to see Locke. And in the next episode, Locke tells Jack that he looked into the eye of this island, an apparent reference to his encounter with the monster. We know that the monster can scan people's memories and take on the form of people from their past. It does it with Mr. Echo in season 2. So maybe the monster appeared to Locke as Helen or someone else he loved or took on some form that would simply be more appealing to Locke besides a cloud of black smoke. So like what I guess my prompt for you guys based on that from listener Matt is, you know, despite what Terry O'Quinn was playing, what do you think he saw, Neil?
Well, I almost assume not necessarily that it's like because he sees the monster at such a high angle. So you have to assume that there's like some of it is the smoke monster. Yeah. But yeah, maybe it's like looking into the fire in Game of Thrones where if it wants to reveal something to you, it will reveal it. And like it reveals it on some sort of subconscious level so that, you know, what Locke sees is, you know, maybe Helen in bright white light or something like that. Or, you know, it's not about what he sees. It's about what enters his mind at that moment would be my idea.
Dave, what do you think?
I like the Zool illusion there. I think it's absolutely a column of black smoke. Whether or not he sees things in that that are part of a hallucination that the monster or the man in black makes him have, I think is different. But I think at this point, Locke's looking for... he knows the island's special, and he knows it's a miracle, and he's sort of shared it with Walt, but nothing huge has happened to anybody that proves that this is a miracle. There's something big in the woods, but nobody's really seen it, so it could just be like, you know, a giant animal or something else weird that's happened on this island. So I think a unexplainable sentient column of smoke sort of brachiosauring down at you and judging you and then running away. I think in the one of the scenes they shot was that the smoke monster was supposed to kill a boar before confronting Locke, implying that maybe Locke didn't even kill that boar, like the smoke monster gave it to him to like drag it back to camp. But just the idea that you need to position Locke as the man of faith in this episode. And I think that's what it does. The island shows him, yes, it's not just you. I am magic. And that's what he means to me. I think it's definitely a right, column of black smoke, though.
It's the first time that we're starting to become aware that the island is aware of the presence of these people. Like that something in the island is reaching out to them. Like the characters are now starting to discover this because, like Dave said, it could have been an animal, but Locke is the first, he's the first point of like, well, I guess not even, because Kate also escapes the monster, but she doesn't have any, like, profound contact with it. Whereas, like, Locke, yeah. It's like, oh, the island is talking back now.
This well, idea, I think it's still a... Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, it feeds on weakness, or it feeds on what it wants to know. So for Locke has that moment of doubt when he gets knocked down by the boar that maybe he's not going to be able to walk again, that maybe it was... You know, he got knocked out of a plane and something clicked back together in his spine, because we don't know this, but the character would know that that's basically what knocked him out of being able to walk in the first place, is a horrible fall. So the monster appears to Locke at the moment when it knows that Locke is so open to believing that he's in a miracle space that he's rushed into the jungle after this boar while the monster has been making a bunch of sound. Like, that makes him as vulnerable as Charlie hiding in the bathroom. Whereas Kate lets her fear out only for 5 seconds and then puts her wall up, and she's not... If you show a black smoke cloud to Kate in the second part of the pilot, she wants to figure out how to fight it or how to run from it. She's not going to be open to it like Locke is in this moment.
Well, and I think she was close... I really like that, and I think she was close because... right before that, she's in the cockpit with the pilot, and the pilot would certainly know that she was the prisoner, right? Like, that's her vulnerable, like, that's her vulnerability. At this point, she doesn't want people to know. She wants that tabula rasa, right? And so, like, she doesn't want people to know that she was the prisoner. And so, like, there's even some reads on that episode that, like, Kate went there or Kate maybe was thinking about killing the pilot. When he woke, I don't really believe that, but I did close watch Evangeline Lilly's performance. She's definitely like giving him some weird looks and some fearful looks. Like, are you about to blow my cover? Like, do you know who I am? And are you about to tell everyone who I am? I just got this fresh start. Like, what's going on? Sort of thing. So that's a huge vulnerability that Kate has hanging out there in the beginning. Let's skip past, we're going to circle back to Christian Shepherd and this appearance and what's dead and what's not in the island. But, you know, given that we're talking about Locke here, and I like the theory that, like, the smoke monster kills the boar, let's say, for Locke in a way that makes Locke even more vulnerable, even more open to, like, I have this special relationship with this thing. Do you know what I mean? That's like a seduction tactic. Here,
right.
Let me help you be useful to this group. I'm on your side. We have a connection, whatever, you know what I mean? Sort of.
Well, it also puts him in a position where Locke's going to find comfort in the jungle, whereas everybody else is going to still be scared of it and have to be driven to the beach or later to the cave. But Locke's going to get to gallivant all around, which is going to lead him to the plane and the hatch eventually.
Right. Okay. So let us circle back to this topic that Dave most wants to talk about, which is Locke the villain? This email comes again from Matt, and he writes, I want to end with my thoughts on the debate about whether or not Locke is the villain of the show. Of course, we know the overarching villain is the smoke monster / man in black, who ultimately takes on the form of Locke. But is the real John Locke a villain? I would say it depends on the season. In season one, I believe he is definitely set up to be the primary antagonist, if only because his primary objective is at odds and in direct conflict with the larger group. Everybody wants to get off the island except Locke, and I will say parenthetically, Joanna is saying, and Walt. And not only does he want to stay on it, he actually does things to prevent the other survivors from potentially securing rescue. In a way, he's also responsible for Boone's death, the only major death of the season. But this changes further into the show, especially once we see the impact his death has on Jack. By that he means Locke's death has on Jack. It really is the motivator that gets Jack back onto the island and into his role as the island's protector. So I, even though this is like Dave's most favorite topic, I want to throw to Neil verse. Neil, like, what do you think of this framing as Locke, as low level antagonist, but not overarching villain of the show?
Yeah. My read on Locke has always been that it's not as simple as, you know, someone's the villain, someone's the hero. It really is back to that man of faith, man of science thing where it's where those paths drive Locke and Jack that they continue to be intertwined as the show goes on. And Locke is there to sort of, I don't know, play devil's advocate to, you know, the people who are continuing to try and live in the real world, I guess. So yeah, I don't know if I've ever really read him as a villain. It's very easy in the first season to see him as an antagonist, but in this episode, we learn, you know, like in the first episode, in the pilot, it's weird that he's calm. Like that's the off-putting thing about Locke is like, why is this guy super calm? What's going on with him? You know, and then all the way up to the point where we learn that he was in a wheelchair, it like none of his confidence makes sense other than this guy is, you know, he has this sort of, this guy's trying to take over kind of thing. You know, like once the group needs his skill, which, he believes this to be hunting, then he sort of ascends very quickly as like one of the leaders of this group. And that is sort of villain behavior. But we then learn very almost immediately that he has gone through something so profound that we can't really even wrap our minds around it yet. And so, yeah, so I don't know if I ever read Locke as the villain, even all the way through, but I'm curious to see how that changes because especially when we get into sort of the later stuff where it's the Man in Black and Jacob and sort of all of that, maybe I'll change my mind, but at the moment, I don't feel he never really felt villainy to me. Especially after this episode.
Dave?
I think antagonist is probably the better word, but I want to take some objection to him getting Jack back being a good thing. Because Jack can only come back once Jack's broken enough to become a man of faith, which makes him a dangerous tool in either of the god beings' hands. Thank Nico. And the second one...
Nico's obviously on board with this theory.
Yeah. Is that he has to bring John Locke's body back, which is the chosen host for the Man in Black, who, maybe this brings us back to Christian Shepherd, likes to take bodies that are actually on the island as his form. Maybe that gives him more power. Maybe it's easier for him. Maybe he doesn't need to scan it from a memory. But in coming back to the island, John Locke has to die and be brought back to the island, which is basically like prep for Man in Black inhabitants. So yeah, I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing. I think Locke's an antagonist in the sense that he gets the wrong message from Faith, ultimately, which is that Locke thinks that there's something bigger outside of him that's going to elevate him when, as we were talking about with like Joanna's overarching theory, Jack realizes that that something bigger outside of him is like also a group of people. It's not the island. He doesn't want, like, power. He doesn't want glory. He doesn't have that curiosity that faith can lead. He doesn't need the definitions to his faith by the time he gets there, which I think is very helpful. And I think also is communicatable to real life in the sense that, you know, even like Christianity has multiple denominations and those things aren't like gigantic differentiations in faith. Like everybody basically believes that Jesus Christ died for our sins. That's like makes you a Christian. The things that break you apart is when you start debating what the definitions of that faith are, when it matters how many Swan stations there are, when it matters how many people need to be on a plane to get back to the island. When faith starts having rules, it's a dangerous faith. And that's why Locke always represents that dangerous part of faith as the antagonist. And I think it's in, especially in season one, for everything that Matt outlined, he's, yeah, antagonistic to everybody's goals on the island.
Okay. Well, he's like recklessly certain from the beginning.
Right. But then there's like moments of uncertainty, which I like sure. so much that modulate the performance. Okay. So like this is a perfect way to segue into our next topic. When you're talking about faith and rules, which is the introduction of Christian Shepherd, which is like, if there's a name on this show that's more heavy-handed than John Locke, it's Christian Shepherd. And given that the show all ends, in a house of worship, somewhere, that this idea of like faith, a regulated faith, that's not named, but is something, is important. So anyway, Christian Shepherd, Jack's father, appears. It's not the actor who plays him. It's a double, but, we get a man in a suit, with sneakers on disappearing into the jungle and Jack is to understand that that is Christian, Shepherd. Susan wrote in and she wrote, like Jack seeing his father in jungle, what's your opinion? Do you think it was the man in black or Jacob taking over Jack's father's body in order to lead them to the water in the cave? We know, of course, the backstory on the cave. So there seems to be a purpose in both getting Jack's attention and leading him there. Thoughts? So Susan wrote that, and I've been reading the Lost encyclopedia. DK put out this like encyclopedia of Lost. It is, I mean, if you're here in this storm, maybe you don't care about spoilers. It is just a spoiler from cover to cover. So like, you can't read that thing if you haven't seen all of the show. It starts with, an entry on Aaron, is alphabetical. It starts with an entry on Aaron. And I was like, oh yeah, Claire's yeah. Jack's sister. I totally forgot that. There's like all this sort of stuff in there. So,
since we started this podcast, I really enjoy the small moments that I had to be like, no, Joanna's spoiling things here. I drew the line when you tweeted a picture just of that book, being like, look at this book. And I like zoomed in and I'm like, oh my God. Oh my God, there's spoilers all over this Instagram post. And then I realized I wasn't going to just torture you with it.
I thought I picked a fairly innocuous page. It was Kate's page and it was like, I was like, well, we've already seen Kate. I picked the page on purpose, but maybe I didn't look at it. I was hoping people wouldn't zoom. I was hoping that if people didn't want to know spoilers, they weren't going to zoom in closely on a page.
Right.
Lost.
No, it ended up being really smart, which is why there's not a comment on that Instagram post from me being like, spoilers much, because I definitely like wrote that and then
I did
decide.
Dave zoomed in on it, is what he's saying.
I did put some thought into it. Anyway, so what we're trying to determine right now, there are, if you're new to the show or not, there are manifestations of dead people on this island. What seems to be true is that sometimes those manifestations of dead people are the man in black / the smoke monster taking on the form of dead people. And he does take on the form of Christian Shepherd from time to time. And sometimes those dead people are like the undead or visions trapped on the island, sort of like their own thing. From the online Lostopedia, Christian is, along with Locke, Yemi, Alex, and Claudia, someone who is deceased, either had contact with the island while alive or as a corpse, and continues to appear on the island after death. A few of Yemi's appearances, and Yemi, if you don't remember, is Mr. Echo's brother. You'll meet him in season 2. A few of Yemi's appearances were confirmed to be influenced by the monster in the official Lost podcast. However, Christian was confirmed as being one of three characters, Yemi and Kate's horse being the other two, to be classified as quote-unquote undead. Alex similarly died on the island and later appeared as a manifestation of the monster. Ben's mother and Richard's wife both died elsewhere, but have also appeared on the island. So my interpretation of this is that there are actually are no hard and fast rules as to who, like, you don't have to have died on the island for the man in black to appear as you. And also, not every appearance of Christian Shepherd is the man in black. So guess what? Like, it's whatever the writers need it to be. It's sort of like Bran's powers on Game of Thrones. Like, the undead on the island worked however Bran's powers work on Game of Thrones. Do you guys have any further thoughts on this, Neil?
Well, and I think in this case, because as we talked about earlier, it leads them to the water cave, right? And that's the whole purpose of Jack seeing him in this early. So I guess it almost doesn't matter whether it's the men in black leading them to it or whether it's like the island's spirit leading them to it. You know, it's sort of at this point not an issue. But it becomes an issue later where like you have to be able to explain away some of those appearances.
I texted this question to Dave. I was reading the encyclopedia and it said something about how like the whispers of the undead trapped on the island that like Rousseau, at the end of season one, Rousseau misinterprets the whispers of the dead on the island. She thinks they're coming for Aaron, the baby, but in fact, they were trying to warn of people coming for Walt. But that what we hear when we hear all those whispering is not Ben and the others doing some sort of like spooky trick, but like the trapped souls of the undead on the island, which is not something that I like ever understood was a factor of this show, but apparently it is. Anyway, Dave, do you have any further thoughts about the dead, the undead, and the manifestations and visions and all of that?
I mean, I imagine we'll be revisiting it a lot, especially once we start hearing whispers and whatnot, like you were talking about. But for this episode specifically, I think this is actually a Starbuck, which is a science fiction television way of saying an angel, because Jack's this version of Christian Shepherd does lead him to the coffin, and the coffin's empty.
It's empty.
But I think that's a close enough echo to there's no reason at this point for the monster to want them to be in the cave. Like, Locke does have like the, oh, our own Adam and Eve thing, but that's more like another creepy thing Locke says. That's not like the monster would want them desperate at this point. But given that Christian Shepherd, like you said, appears in the flash sideways, I think it's possible that he is the thing that Jack needs to see in order for him to be on the side of good, even though he's like such a man of science. If you show Jack, a smoke monster or a ghost, his mind is not going to be able to comprehend that. But show him his father in a situation where, you know, he thought his father was dead, but he doesn't know where the body is. That's just enough for Jack to be unnerved. And I think that could go positively or negatively. So I feel like this one, though, is Angel.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, we don't have to say Angel. Well, we can say Angel. But, like, a positive manifestation of a dead person. A helpful Starbucks manifestation. A Starbucks, sure. We don't ever...
You know, just spoil other series.
They don't ever find Christian Shepherd's body, right?
No.
Yeah, that's fascinating. One other Christian Shepherd thing before we roll on and wrap this episode up is the shoes. Apparently, I had forgotten this, but the shoes that Christian's wearing sneakers because he didn't have shoes on. And like Jack was like, fuck it. He doesn't get dress shoes. He can just wear like some of my sneakers that I have. So that's why Christian Shepherd's wearing sneakers. And in fact, even though they don't at all match because like, he's wearing like cushy Nikes and what's in the tree is like a boat shoe. But apparently like the shoe that you see in the opening and closing of the show, that's supposed to be Christian's shoe in the tree. So, they don't match. That bothers me. But apparently according to the DK Lost Encyclopedia, which was vetted by the showrunners, that's supposed to be Christian Shepherd's shoe. All right. We got one quick email from Heather Bixler, who says, I wanted to stick up for Dave and Neil regarding remembering 108 is one of the numbers. Well, it wasn't one of the lottery computer, et cetera, numbers. It is an important number in the show and is the sum of 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, and 42. So they weren't entirely wrong. So there's that.
Nailed it.
Not entirely wrong. Not entirely wrong.
And then I have a few lost storm notes really quickly. It's fun to watch Sun pretend she doesn't understand English. That's always fun. It's nice to see Sun is like already gathering plants, planting, leading the way for her to have her big garden later. I like that Shannon calls Boone Captain America, which is sort of this, you know, well before Captain America was something that we were all like, you know, obviously famous in the comic books, not as widely famous as he is now, but like, this is a clue into like who the Boone character could have been. I have a really some fun thoughts on Boone and Ian Somerhalder. I read a bunch of Ian Somerhalder interviews about why his character was killed off and what he felt like he did wrong and stuff like that, and why Boone never worked as a character on the show that we will visit when Boone dies. But just like thinking of him as like, oh, could he have been? That is hard to make a Captain America character work. And like, kudos to Chris Evans for making Captain America / Steve Rogers like a compelling character when that is just like a hard figure to be interested in. Does that make sense?
Like the intense earnestness of the character?
Yeah. The do-goodery of, right. You know what I mean? Shout out to the introduction of Nadia in photograph form. That's fun.
Fun fact about that.
Yeah.
It was up until like the day before they shot that. Actually, I think they shot it with nothing on the photo, and they had to add her, the actress, in later because they had not yet cast her.
Very nice. Shout out to the fact that Locke has asked his escort to use the name Helen, which is the name of his actual girlfriend at one point, but you know, blah blah. Shout out to the introduction of my boy Bernard, who we will meet later in the tailies. And before we get to this like super kooky last email from Raymond, I was wondering if you guys had any other like storm notes that you wanted to roll through.
Let me see here. Knife speech, machine sounds, Shannon and Boone cause a fish bet because they're talking about Rose. No, I don't think that means Rose knows anything besides thing. Nope, I think I'm good.
I mean, do you think they, I guess this is something that I will shout out to our listeners, cause you guys were so helpful sending us, some interviews about the numbers. But I don't know that they knew yet that Rose had cancer, but like Rose is obviously linked to Locke in that way in our minds later, that they both experienced like a miraculous cure. But I don't know that they knew that necessarily when they wrote her into this episode this way. You know, when you were asking me about why I thought Rose was in this episode, I don't think it's because of that. Right?
Yeah, I mean, right. maybe.
Right, maybe. So, stormofspoilers@gmail.com if you have any other ideas. Neil, do you have any other...
The only counter-argument I'd make is that why would she go off and sit and not eat or drink if it wasn't she thought that, like, she was just going to drift away? Like, maybe it's not just missing Bernard, you know, like, maybe she's just like, I would like to still be involved with things, is her realizing that she's, like, gonna participate until she dies. Like, I don't know if she knows that she's cured yet, because it's only been 3 days, and I imagine everybody's hurting from crashes and whatnot. I don't know, I've never had cancer, so now I'm now I'm speaking out of school. But I also like the idea that in the perfect world where these are characters that existed and knew the things that the writers already didn't know, that she went off just to quietly drift away thinking about her husband and not bother anybody. That tracks as Rose for me.
All right. So maybe we'll have some answers about that for us. Neil, do you have any other storm notes, storm thoughts before we dive into this last like downpour of a storm question that I want? I want to hear you guys' thoughts on.
I have one more. Yes. Fun fact. In the scene where Locke is being berated by Randy, his super shitty boss, right, Randy? Mm-hmm. So there's two things in that scene that I thought were really interesting. The prominence of the two vending machines, because Jack Bender said they wanted to put things in these flashbacks around the characters that they never had. Like, they wanted to put them in positions where it's like, now they don't have vending machines anymore because they're on the island. Also, Locke mentions Norman Croucher having climbed Mount Everest. This is where David Fury admits that they totally screwed up the trivia, because Norman Croucher, who was a double amputee who climbed a bunch of mountains, never actually did climb Mount Everest.
Whoops.
Yep.
That's how we know we're in the Game of Thrones universe. It's because of the history.
Classic. Yep. Classic Fury. We should say David Fury apparently, maybe, perhaps, fired from Lost acrimoniously. I suppose we'll get there as we journey on. But David Fury.
There's a really, if you listen to the commentary track for this episode, there's a really awkward moment at the end because Terry O'Quinn is in Hawaii recording his part, and David Fury and Jack Bender are in LA, where Terry O'Quinn says, "Jack, I'll see you soon. David, I hope to see you again as soon as possible."
Like,
it was like, yikes. It was like after he was not working on the show anymore.
Yikes. Cool. Yeah. Cool story. Terry O'Quinn's like, "It's nice here in Hawaii, David. Hope you ever make it back here again." All right. All right. This last email comes from Raymond, and this is something that I'm really excited to hear both of you on. Diving into deep Lost mythology here. This is Raymond sort of unified. And I would love that. If you guys want to email us in stormspoilers@gmail.com, your unified theory of Lost, which is something we've been talking about a lot. We'd love to hear it. But Raymond says, diving into deep Lost mythology here, the light on the island is the element of time and the smoke monster is the past incarnate. Jacob equals Father Time versus Man in Black, the ghost of Christmas past. From a plot execution level, this would mean the survivors are both literally and figuratively running from their pasts. I'm not even sure I can fully parse what Raymond is talking about here, but that is my favorite kind of Lost theory, to be honest with you. So let's start with Neil. Do you have any thoughts on like Raymond's assessment here?
So I do like the idea of like the running from the past. One of the things that I find interesting about all of these characters is that they all are in some way uniquely skilled to be on this island, and not necessarily in like that Locke has a bunch of knives. A lot of them have like a duplicity to them. Like they are able to be, there was some sort of duplicity in their previous lives that gets wiped away when they get onto the island. And so in that sense, yes, they are sort of they're constantly fighting their past, which I think is almost feels super simple to me because of the whole flashbacks thing. But yeah, I mean, I get it. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Dave?
I've read some posts on the theory of the light being time. I like this idea of like the Father Time versus Ghost of Christmas Past idea. The thing that makes that, I don't like those totems necessarily, but I do like the idea of somebody that is working for fixed time versus somebody that's working for, I don't know. So the difference between the Man in Black and Jacob in terms of like world out view is that the Man in Black, and they both sort of think that humans are like inexorably evil, but Jacob thinks that there can be some good in them and that that light is manifested in everybody, and to let the light go out around the world would be taking that out, or let the light go out on the island means it goes out around the world and that takes it away from somebody. And so the argument that is made in a lot of these time arguments is that that is everything's at stake. You take everybody's time away to the point that the world ends, which is what the Valenzetti equation's been predicting this entire time, that time stops or linear time stops, and all we have is our experiences up to that point. And that sort of makes living on Earth the actual purgatory or hell, since we know from post-show interviews that Lost didn't have a purgatory or hell. I really like that idea of time and this battle between good and evil being mixed up in time really sort of makes the time thing lesser for me, because time's so inherently not good or evil, that I think it crosses a few two wires, but really only at the end of season 6. When the show has to open up to also talk about like friendship and a church with glass windows from different religions, and has a whole bunch of money, has a whole bunch of stuff on its time, on its mind, and that isn't time. But I really like this theory. We're gonna have to see if it holds past the third season, I would say, but the fourth season, there's a really, really interesting argument to be made about the smoke monster being like sort of anti-time, beginning with how did it get back to ancient Egypt for the summoning chamber when that kind of when isn't when we originally saw the castaways on the island, the original Man in Black, Jacob castaways. That's a really complex answer to say. It's an interesting theory that I'm 80% on board with.
Excellent. Well, I love that. This idea, I want to think more about time as we go forward, because, you know, time travel is a thing. Having constants, you know, like we're way ahead of getting to like Daniel Faraday and stuff like that. But the idea that time travel and becoming unstuck in time and the ghosts of our past literally haunting us on this island and stuff like that is such an important part of the show. One of our listeners wrote in, I didn't include this email in our roundup, but like wrote in saying like, they were watching Lost for the first time. I think they said this. And then they're like, oh, it reminds me of like the structure of Orange is the New Black. And it's like, yeah, well, Orange is the New Black took that structure from Lost. So, you know, this idea that runs out of steam midway through season two, probably, which is like, we can do backstories on all these characters and it will have an ironic reflection on the current, thing that they're experiencing on the island. And then they just sort of like, I don't know if they messed up by like showing their hands too quickly with like some of these stories or whatever, but like I find some of the repeated backstories interesting. Like every Locke flashback is actually quite interesting to me, even though it tells a similar story.
Yeah. I think Charlie's the only one that they've expressed some remorse. Not that they did Charlie wrong, but I remember Damon Lindelof in one of his interviews, I believe it was with Vox, was like, I kind of wish we didn't have to go back to drugs as many times as we did. But yeah. Otherwise, I think there's a lot of it. And you're right that when the show starts showing fatigue, it's when the writers were like, ABC, can we please get to our ending? Because like, we have an ending we'd like to do and it's going to take a few episodes, but like, just tell us when we could get out of the cages, out of the polar bear cages, and we'll write our way out of the polar bear cages. But otherwise, what do Jack's tattoos mean?
Yeah, exactly. So there we go. So that is all of our walkabout thoughts. What are we watching next week, guys?
White Rabbit.
Bum, bum,
Episode 5.
Yeah, it was really hard talking in the calm section about a lot of the stuff that happened to Jack in this episode and not be like, this is a perfect example of setting up Act 1 of your next episode through a storyline. Of just like, just really fuck Jack up and then throw him his dead father next week. Anyway, it's going to be interesting to go back to a Jack flashback this soon after we've been, you know, exploring other characters and revelations, but we're going to do it with White Rabbit. Until then, where can people find your work around the internet? Let's start as we do with Mr. Neil Miller.
You get me over at filmschoolrejects.com on Twitter at rejects or at one perfect shot, where there's a lot of Lost shots slipping through these days. I don't know how that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget to email us all your Lost thoughts, stormofspoilers@gmail.com, and follow us on Twitter at stormofspoilers.
And Miss Joanna Robinson.
Yeah, you can find me on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter, at JoWritheThisM. I'm on a little, externally enforced Twitter hiatus this week because I'm on vacation, but otherwise you can find me there. Or you can listen to me talk about Big Little Lies soon on the Still Watching podcast.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find my writing at polygon.com, at thrillist.com. You can find more of my talking at Fighting in the War Room, my other podcasts. And you could find all of us on the island and doing the most important thing to all of us passengers that survived, which is not falling down. If we learned anything from Locke this episode, don't fall down. That's where all the doubt comes from.